Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest today is Brian Hamilton. Brian, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on, Scott.
I'm very excited. Tell the people a little bit about yourself.
So my main gig is freelance videography. I've made a whole bunch of internal things for a bunch of clients, but in the podcasting sphere, I've done the TV recaps for Game of Thrones the past two seasons, the second season of True Detective right here on the Incomparable Network, and I host the ADR podcast solo by myself and Garrulous with Kyle Seth Gray over on my Squarespace site. So that's me in the podcasting sphere, but tonight in the podcasting sphere, I'm hanging out with you, so I'm excited for that.
So my question to you is, did you agree to be on the True Detective Season 2 podcast before True Detective Season 2 came out? And were you very disappointed in it?
I love the first season, watched the first episode of the second, and felt promise, which is when me and Moe's got together and started the TV feed on The Incomparable, and we regretted it two episodes later. So we kept up with it. It was fun, but no, you're right. It was not the most fun we could have had podcasting.
I know we're not here to talk about True Detective, but I did watch the first season of True Detective, and like everybody else who has HBO or access to it, and I enjoyed it. I did not watch any of the second season, though, because so many horrible, horrible reviews.
You are not missing out on a single thing. Don't worry.
Although I applaud them for kind of the anthology direction of the whole thing. And kind of, I think that I've heard many people in the Star Trekosphere talk about how one possible way of getting Star Trek back on TV would be to do a similar kind of True Detective thing, where you do an anthology of one season, limited run, how many episodes? Like six episodes in True Detective, right? So you could have six episodes of, a Star Trek story, tell a whole story in those six episodes, and then go out to somewhere else and tell that story, which is an interesting idea.
Well, certainly. Well, the main reason I feel like that would work is because the old format for the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, however many years Star Trek's been running for the longest time, most episodes are their own little silo, which is why jumping into Voyager completely randomly for the very first time, I was, I don't want to say shocked, but I was, you know, excited by the fact that I could jump right in and, you know, really understand some of these characters. This was the episode we're doing tonight is Vis-a-Vis and season 4, episode 20, and I'm a big fan of the fact that, you know, this was centered on a character who, when you look at the big Netflix banner, was like the second to last person on the right side of the pyramid.
Yeah, it's good old Tom Paris. And so yeah, that is the strength of most Star Trek before Deep Space Nine. I know we were talking about this before, and I haven't asked you my customary questions yet, but we could talk about how Deep Space Nine is the first Star Trek series, and I know you haven't watched any Deep Space Nine, to embrace this kind of what is commonplace now on TV, story arcs and having continual character growth. And, you know, you could jump into a deep, they have like nine episode arcs in Deep Space Nine. So if you come in on, you know, you're randomly assigned the fifth episode in a nine episode arc, you're not going to have any idea what's going on, which makes it a challenge for someone who hosts a random Star Trek podcast. But Voyager didn't really do that. Voyager has some of some arcs and obviously some continuing themes throughout, mostly with Seven of Nine and Janeway. And I feel like Voyager is kind of like maybe a little prototypical in that it has much more character growth than you would find in The Next Generation. Because The Next Generation was purely, like, you know, episodic. Everything seemed to reset except for some two-parters, and that was that. But that was the style at the time, as they say.
My favorite was scrolling through the Netflix series to find this particular episode and seeing part one at the end of a season and seeing part two at the beginning of next season. I was like, oh my god, why would you do that? That's incredible. But you're right. I mean, it feels much more modern to have shows that really keep a single narrative arc going for more than a few episodes, especially now that Netflix and everything is so prevalent, and HBO has really made a killing with, you know, series like True Detective, where they you know, you can have an eight episode arc and then cut it and it's done, and then next season of True Detective is another piece of the anthology. So if that would be incredible if, say, Netflix picked up Star Trek for a few series of of, you know, 10 episode arcs like you were mentioning. That would be incredible, especially now that that seems much more commonplace, because Voyager was what, mid-90s, late-90s?
Yes, I think it started, well, late-90s, so it started, must have started, what, 94, and then it had 7 seasons, so...
Right, right. So
I'm always surprised that it had 7 seasons.
But right, so the 90s was when these kinds of things really started. I remember when Seinfeld season 4 had a season-long arc of them trying to get the pile off the ground, and everyone's like, a sitcom? Half-hour sitcom with an arc? What the hell are they doing? It's incredible.
It's crazy. It's a show about nothing. How could it have a story arc? It's craziness. I will say, though, I was talking about Lisa Schmeiser. I wasn't talking about Lisa Schmeiser. I was talking with Lisa Schmeiser a couple
about
episodes.
Lisa Schmeiser.
About Lisa. It was it's my All About Lisa podcast that I co-host with Lisa. About how the kids today, we were the old people on our porch, how the people just don't appreciate the fact that there was a time when you couldn't just immediately watch the next episode of a show. And so the thing that you said that made me think of this is that typically in the Star Trek series, it is not uncommon for a season to end with a cliffhanger. And then you have to wait months to find out what happens next. And the one that is seared in my mind is the Next Generation cliffhanger, where Jean-Luc Picard becomes a Borg, and it ends with, you know, the big reveal that he's a Borg. And then you have to wait months to find out what happens.
Months? That's horrible.
It's craziness. Now you watch it, and then Netflix says, if you don't do anything for 30 seconds, it just starts the next one.
The difference between 30 seconds and several months is relatively massive.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty young. I'm in my early 20s, and all of my friends are in that one more episode mentality. And sometimes I just want to watch one thing and then move on to something else, or get off the sofa and do something. I'm not very big into the binging thing unless I'm deliberately sitting down to binge. It's not my, you know, get home after a day of work and then sit down and watch 3 or 4 episodes of something. It's mostly like, okay, I will watch something unless I devote a whole day to binge watch a whole season of something. But I'm not, you know, into the whole, watching so many things all in one sitting. So having a little capsule of a story like Voyager makes it feel okay to stand up after an episode and not really be grasping at what wants to happen next.
Right, because at the end of this episode, you know what happens. It's done. It's a complete story. And people are making out in a car. That's all you need. Done.
Okay, you want to jump into the episode? Because I have some very bizarre thoughts about the very beginning of this episode.
Well, I need to ask you some questions, and then we'll jump into this episode. Because first, I want to... I always ask people if they consider themselves a Star Trek fan, so we'll need to find out the answer of this question. Do you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
I'm going to have to say no, but not for lack of... I was going to say for a lack of trying, but that sounds like I don't like Star Trek. It makes it, what is most intimidating to me about Star Trek is how much there is in there, and finding a place to start was always the most difficult thing for me. So, I've seen the Abrams movies, I've seen The Wrath of Khan, and I've seen the Tribbles episode of the original series, and that's it, prior to, when I watched Vis-a-Vis, for this podcast. Yeah,
that's all you need. You hit the high points. You could use a Space Seed from the original series also, which is the precursor to Wrath of Khan. But other than that.
Right. I mean, Wrath of Khan does a relatively good job of bringing you right back up to speed with who Khan is, why he's pissed off, and what he's trying to do. So,
yes. Yeah. They establish that fairly clearly very early on, so that people are not like, why is that nice man from Fantasy Island want to kill Captain Kirk?
Right, exactly. But the way I feel about Star Trek is exactly the same way I feel about comics, and especially Marvel, now that the cinematic universe is such a huge thing. Finding a place to jump in and being someone who wants to get a full story, being able to jump in and only get slivers of a story, or being able to know a character right from their introduction up until when they die or the series ends or whatever. I want to know the full story. So the intimidating thing about Star Trek is, do I have to go back and watch every single original series episode before I go over to the Next Generation, before I go to Deep Space Nine, etc.? So that's my biggest fear with jumping into Star Trek. I like what I've seen, but it's been much more of a mental effort than I expected to say, okay, I'm going to jump in and do this and try to, really wrap my head about everything that's here.
Well, I can understand that. I have a similar reticence, or I did have a similar reticence, I should say, with Doctor Who, because Doctor Who has years and years. Like, so I think actually this month marks the 49th anniversary of Star Trek, and Doctor Who has been on the air for longer than that. So
its 50th was a few years ago, right? With that big Doctor.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yes. Dr. Palooza. There are doctors everywhere. And so when there was a reboot, obviously, I'm a giant nerd, so I was like, ooh, Doctor Who, I know there's this big history, so I should try and watch some older Doctor Who so I can understand what's going on. And I tried watching that, and the problem with that, and I see a similar problem with the original series, is that, you know, 50 years ago, TV was very different.
Mm-hmm.
And pacing was different. Acting styles were vastly different.
Let's film a play. It'll be fine.
Exactly. I just keep the cameras rolling. And especially for the BBC, production value was very different. The original series in America, I feel like, they spent a little bit more on production values, and I've talked about this ad nauseum, so people who listen are annoyed, but if, you are going to watch the original series, which I suggest you do because it's lovely. Mm-hmm. Make sure you watch the remastered versions because CBS spent an incredible amount of money, I assume, cleaning up all of the film, redoing all the special effects, and they issued them in Blu-ray, but they're available in streaming now as well. And they're just beautiful.
Oh, that's incredible.
And they're fantastic. And the best thing is, because I know a lot of some purists would be like, ugh, I don't want these crappy special effects. I want the original, campy kind of special effects.
Like some other Star property we may know of.
Exactly. but you can, unlike that Star property, you can turn off the new special effects and watch it in the original, just cleaned up. And so it just looks pristine and fantastic. At least on the Blu-rays. I don't know if both versions are available in streaming.
Oh, that's incredible, though. I've never seen anybody have that kind of commitment to preserving the originals, especially. I guess you have to do that for Star Trek because of all the history that's there. But no, I really appreciate the fact that people are keeping both around. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's great. And if you're not a Star Trek fan yet, you don't know if you're a Star Trek fan.
I'd say I call myself a fan. Well, I like it. I wouldn't call myself a fan to
Star
your
Trek
level
curious.
Or anybody's level.
But yeah, and so they did the same thing for The Next Generation, which also looks great. That was, I think, the original series was filmed on film, like shot on film, so that made it easier. I believe The Next Generation was shot on tape, so that made it harder for them to do it, but they did it. They remastered it. I don't know all the, I'm sure you know the technical details better than I do, so I'm not going to explain it, but it looks great. This is a long-winded way of saying, you can really jump in anywhere in Star Trek. I have a spreadsheet with every episode of Star Trek on it, and it's like 680 episodes. There's a lot of Star Trek.
Oh my God, that's incredible. There really is a lot. I mean, going back to Doctor Who, there's all of those things there with the different doctors. They're really, I guess the Abrams movies kind of count, but there really isn't like a New 52 place to start with the Abrams things, except for the two movies. And,
right.
You know, in our ideal world where they make a Netflix series, that'd be incredible. But who knows? Maybe that might not happen for another few years. So the best place to do, I guess, would be to go back and, you know, really dig deep into that, because all of the Abrams stuff from the very little that I know of how Abrams translated older Star Trek properties and ideas into, you know, 2009 or whatever, I gather that there's a lot of the same ideas and story elements there, but with 21st century pacing and ideas in terms of the filmmaking and all that stuff. All those things are doing their best to preserve it. I don't know how you feel about the Abrams movies, but I think they seem to do a well enough job. I probably just dug my own grave. Oh God.
No, I chuckle only because there's a great rift in Star Trek fandom, because how could there not be, about the Abrams movies and whether people like them or not. Some people think that they're fine action movies, but they're not really Star Trek movies. Some people are angry about mostly the second movie because of its inversion, spoiler alert, its inversion of The Wrath of Khan. Mm-hmm. And so people are like, well, why couldn't they come up with an original story? It seems like kind of cheap, and they're trying to, you know, trade on my feelings for The Wrath of Khan, which is, in fact, one of my favorite movies, period. Not start so any good. Kind of movie. But I like them. I think they're fun. I like any Star Trek that I can get. I was worried a little bit about the actors doing impersonations of the original actors, but I feel like, to get fancy compare it to Shakespeare, but I'm going to, they have taken the roles and reinterpreted them so that they're not just, Chris Pine isn't doing a William Shatner doing Kirk. He is mm-hmm. playing Kirk and giving it his own little spin, but it's definitely the same character. And the same goes for, all the other guys and gals. Sadly, doesn't get much to do.
Yeah, going back to Marvel Comics, that's the only way I can justify all of these different properties and versions of movies to myself. I'm really trying to drive into my head the fact that Spider-Man at this point is kind of like a mythical character that you mm-hmm. can take and make movies with and like make that story your own. I mean, I hear there's a whole bunch of controversy going on about reinventing Spider-Man and making him different, changing the origin story in certain ways to make a third origin story movie. And at this point, it's like he might as well be Jack and the Beanstalk kind of person, where you have that one archetypical story and you can do whatever you want with it. You can have Peter Parker, you can have somebody else, I don't know. But you're right, in terms of Shakespeare, that is the ultimate like revitalization or reinvention medium, for the lack of a better word, where anybody can come in and take Shakespeare and do weird Romeo plus Juliet things with it, or I don't know, middle school plays. That's exactly how I feel about Marvel Comics, and that's probably where Star Trek is headed in terms of the Abrams movies.
I think so. And there's also a group of people who does Star Trek in the Park, where they act out original series episodes in, I think, Portland, maybe?
Oh, my God. Wait, no. Where have I heard about this? The magazine, right?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. There we go. I've heard of that. That's incredible.
So it's happening. And there's also a huge, maybe not huge, but a large group of people who are making their own Star Trek series, which is fascinating to me. And because, nowadays, you know better than I. Once again, the technology is so readily available that anybody with, a little talent and a couple thousand dollars can create something that's pretty professional looking.
Oh, yeah.
And these are I think the Voyage Continues, the Continuing Voyages. I don't know. There are a couple of them out there, and they are fantastic looking. Some of them are their own properties, so they've thought of their own ships and their own characters. Others are telling stories with the original crew, and they've gotten one of the episodes, I will put in the show notes because I can't think of it, but they got an actor from the original series who played a god, and brought him in to play this god, quote unquote god, but he's aged the appropriate amounts, so the characters, obviously Kirk and things, have not aged, but he has, because he's a dude and it's been 40 years. So it's amazing stuff that people are doing.
Oh, that's incredible. Our local Rocky Horror Picture Show Shadowcast here in Boston also does, well, in addition to Firefly and Serenity and all those other things, they do Star Trek episodes shadowcasted like you'd see in a Rocky Horror Picture Show production, which I think is incredible.
Yes, it's a cultural phenomenon. There's no getting around it. And I don't think this is helping you in any way with your reticence, because there's just so much Star Trek. This is just putting more and more baggage in the Star Trek universe.
Well, in my preparation for this, I did watch the documentary, Trekkies.
Trekkies.
Mm-hmm. The documentary from, I believe, like late 80s or so about, Star Trek conventions. Mm-hmm. And, yes, you're right. I mean, especially when it comes to, smaller groups of people creating their own series and things, it must be relatively easy when most of the combat and the tension comes from computer readouts and yelling and dramatic music and camera movements instead of, actual, bam, bam, shoot, shoot, mm-hmm. things like that. Especially in the original series, in the Voyager episode we watched for tonight, there's bits of, ship animation and things, and it looks delightfully 90s and I loved it. But there's moments where they're on the bridge and everybody is, yelling things. Oh, we have this, coaxial warp drive. It's the fastest thing ever made, mm-hmm. and, all of that kind of stuff. When the dialogue can provide that much tension and that much excitement, like you would get in space for something comparable to, I don't know, Doctor Who or Star Wars, I think that's incredible that they were able to pull that off for so many years in that same format.
And it was, I read, I promise we will talk about this Voyager episode, but I read a book, which I will also put in the show notes, that chronicles the making of every episode of the first season of the original series. And wow. This guy has written two more covering the other, or four, are there four seasons? Yeah. So there are four books. I don't know if the fourth one's out. I know the first three are out. And he chronicles, you know, from, script, assignments to how they produced it and the budgetary reasons and all kinds of stuff like that. And the props and how they picked the editor and who was the director and the reaction to it. And it's fascinating to watch because, you know, I was watching Star Trek just as a fan and just enjoying it and not really having any thought as to, oh, this is also a business and they have a budget and they need to, you know, make some decisions based on that budget. So it's interesting to see the choices they make where, you know, you can show something and spend a lot of money, or you can write two lines of dialogue that describes it and you're looking in a scanner and you save all that money.
Yep. No, that's where all that comes from. The economy of storytelling and making sure that you can fit things inside the budgets you want, all that stuff. Now, I do want to ask you, as a commander of the USS Random Trek, when was the first time you saw this episode of Voyager, and how many times have you seen it? Like, how often do you go back and rewatch things like this, especially for the podcast?
Well, this is an interesting question because I, in fact, have not seen all of Voyager. Voyager is, and I haven't seen all of Enterprise, which are both my two least favorite series. I still like them. Nobody write me any angry letters. They are just my least favorite, so I have not seen them all. I have seen every episode of DS9, every episode of The Next Generation, and every episode of the original series. So the first time I saw this episode was when I watched it to talk about it.
Yes, we're on the same page. Great.
Yes. So, and that being said, this episode, I really don't like Tom Paris in general. But I did not dislike him in this episode. So, that's kind of high praise.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, so the episode starts off with him. God, this is how little I know about Star Trek. I didn't realize this was immediately the holodeck.
That could be
until
very
the very
confusing.
End when they start talking about the holodeck. Like, you've been wasting your time here in the holodeck because Paris has been shirking his duties on the sickbay. Mm-hmm. And there's moments in here where I think, how the hell is he on Earth? What's going on?
I thought the whole point of this was that they are lost.
Exactly. And this was one of the points I wanted to bring up. This feels like, have you seen the Will Smith iRobot?
Yes.
There's a moment in there, like the movie takes place in what, 2025, 2030 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the first thing he does in the movie, which is made in 2004 or somewhere around there, was he takes out a pair of really classic Chuck Taylor Converse, which were all the rage when the movie came out. Mm-hmm. And it was like, this is obviously like our human analog on the Voyager at this point, so that we as people literally on Earth watching this TV show can appreciate the people who are on there and have some sort of good old classic Americana to mix in with our space TV show.
Mm-hmm. And Tom Paris serves that purpose in many episodes because they basically write his character to like this kind of, you know, ancient history. So he likes, you know, these surfer music and Camaros, and he watches black and white cartoons, and he is a fan of 50s sci-fi serials. So they have all kinds of wonderful holodeck adventures with Tom Paris and his predilection for 40s and 50s pop culture.
Now, is he like a Fry in Futurama kind of thing where he was transported from the 20th century to the 24th century? Because he seems to know a lot about it, more so than I guess anybody nowadays would, you know, analog-wise, would know about the 16th century.
He is, I believe, just obsessed with... He's not from the 20th century. I know that. Okay. He's just obsessed with it. In one episode, he replicates a tube television so he can watch cartoons on it.
With broadcasts that are still somehow happening, maybe somehow, who knows?
Well, one imagines there's like some little memory chip in there so that it has every cartoon ever made and he's watching it on there. I don't know. They don't go
computer?
Into...
Computer?
Exactly. You know, dial up the Jetsons or something.
Got the new Apple TV in there.
That's right. So yeah, Tom Paris is an interesting character. Who is obsessed with the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So he's got several fronts in this episode. He has his duties in the sick bay. I keep wanting to call it the med bay. I have med bay in my notes. But no, in the sick bay with the doctor.
Which is a voluntary thing.
Which is surprising to me. Like, nah, I don't really feel like curing people. I'd rather work on this Camaro. What's going on in the ship?
Well, Tom Paris is the helmsman, so he pilots the ship. He's the Sulu of Voyager. So there was this character, Kes. I'm not going to get into it, but she left the show. She was the kind of the assistant to the doctor, who was a hologram. I don't know if you picked up on that. But then Tom Paris, basically everyone, you know, they lined up the crew and they said, whoever wants to volunteer, step forward. And the rest of the crew took one step back and Tom Paris was left. And he was like, okay, I'll do it. That did not literally happen, but that's basically what happened. And it's clear throughout this episode that Tom Paris is suffering from a little space ennui. He's been doing the bare minimum, I think is what we get from this. He's spending a lot of time in the holodeck with his holographic car, which is an interesting, as I was watching this, I was thinking, it's not a real car, and he's spending a lot of time fixing it, but you don't get anything at the end of it, right? Because it's just a bunch of photons and force fields.
Exactly. You don't get to drive it down Route 66.
You could in the holodeck. So that led me to this philosophical thought about, is it really, I suppose it is just the act of doing the thing and not necessarily the product. So it's, you know, the journey, not the destination, is what this shows us.
Yeah. What was the last line of the episode? It's hundreds of hours I probably should have spent with you,
that's
his girlfriend.
Right. With his girlfriend.
Sweet.
Instead of playing with an imaginary car. But hey, you know, but there is a point. I have so many questions about the holodeck because at one point, the bad guy in this episode takes a wrench from the holodeck and he leaves the holodeck with it. And I thought to myself, isn't that a hologram? How can he leave with it and then use it? It was very confusing to me.
You're absolutely right. I didn't even think about that. But when they have the replicator technology for things like the booze that, that Paris drinks or
what's his face? Steth?
Sheth? Sketh?
Steth?
Steth.
Steth, yes. Not Steth.
There we go.
Steth.
So I texted you this earlier. Steth ruined Seth in my autocorrect as I was taking notes of this.
I'll do a very high-level brief synopsis of what happens. Basically, Steth, who is this test pilot, appears on the side of Voyager. His ship is having trouble. They stabilize his ship because Tom Paris only paid attention in one class and it happened to be subspace warp geometry
I made a note on that because it was my favorite line of the episode. Advanced subspace geometry. Yes.
There you go. And so he could quickly figure out how to fix this thing. And apparently this ship has some crazy, coaxial warp drive that lets you travel super fast.
I think coaxial warp drives are what bring cable to my apartment. I'm not sure.
I was thinking about that. I was like, they should really switch to fiber warp drives. They're so much faster. Voyager is lost from very far away from home. Any chance they can get to acquire some technology that can make it even faster to get back is a good thing. So that's why they're interested in it. Tom is bored with his duties on Voyager. We get the sense. So he volunteers to help Steth, who is this alien, fix his ship. And I don't know about you, but I immediately did not trust Steth.
One of the first things in my notes is, this guy's a bad guy, isn't he?
He is. And we soon find out that he is trying to get more information about Tom Paris. And there's a weird scene where he's a dude. But then when Tom is like under a console or something, he shifts into being some other kind of lady alien, but his voice doesn't change.
Dude looks like a lady.
Yeah. And then you think to yourself, something's not right with this guy.
Which was weird because, jumping a little bit later, there's moments where everyone's switching bodies because this is an identity thief who's, you know, stealing people's bodies to moving forward or something. And I guess the original body kept popping up in their genetic code or something, because that's why he turns into a woman. That confused me more than the Allen wrench confused me from the holotech.
Yeah, it's not clear how it works, because Tom's body, Like, he transforms into Janeway at one point. Mm-hmm. So, we'll follow the trail first. He, he's, I guess his body, or whatever, is shifting phases, so he needs to switch bodies again. And so clearly Tom is there. He steals the holographic wrench, which is actually a real wrench, I guess, and takes Tom's DNA and, turns into Tom. But when he turns into Tom, it's like the thing from The Flash, where, or maybe from The Fringe, where his body switches with Tom. So Tom gets his old body, and he gets Tom's body.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't get all of Tom's memories, so that's an important thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he, in a scene which made it look like he kills Tom in his body, he didn't actually kill him. He just knocks him out and sends him off on his super fast ship far away.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes into Voyager and he tries to beat Tom, but he doesn't really know anything about Tom and he can't find sickbay and everyone's a little suspicious. Mm-hmm. But luckily,
my favorite moment was when he was in the med bay and he didn't know how to do anything, and so the doctor tries to chalk it up to an inferiority complex. Which was hilarious.
Well, the doctor thinks quite highly of himself.
Quite obviously.
Yes. And I thought it was funny, his first try was, well, I'm not really feeling well, and the doctors are like, well, it's great you're here because I could just run some scans on you. And he's like, no, don't do that, because if you were to scan him, you would know he's not actually Tom Paris.
Well, there is a scan. Okay, we'll get to that later. But there's a scan later where they find two strings of DNA.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. That was weird.
It's very strange. And then, so they figure out basically that he's Tom. He's not Tom because he is becoming erratic. He threatens 7 of 9. He gets drunk on duty. He strangles Captain Janeway, which is never a good thing.
Nope.
When he was strangling Captain Janeway, my wife turned to me and said, "Ooh, do you think that he's now Captain Janeway?" And I actually didn't even put those two things together, but it turns out he was totally
exactly what happened. Yeah.
Exactly what happened. So that was a nice little twist. And so he becomes Janeway, although it is unclear. Like, I don't know where the bodies go. So I guess Tom's, so that's not really Tom's body. It's the other, I don't know. It's very difficult.
The first thing that I thought was, why not, to prove all of this, why not go to Tom's lifeless body that should theoretically be populated by Janeway and ask, hey, who are you? Well, I don't know. I'm Janeway, but oh my God, I'm in Tom's body. That would be a much better way to prove all of this than, you know, talking to Steph Tom.
Yes. Although part of me thinks that the, you know, not to be mean, but the actor who plays Tom Paris perhaps could not act like Janeway, whereas Janeway could, Kate Mulgrew, who's a fantastic actress, can act like Steth, and the actor who plays Steth can act like Tom Paris. That's my only assumption.
Yeah. Have you heard CGP Grey's analysis of Jane Grey or Janeway?
I have not.
So he talked about how, ever since watching Voyager, he awards the Janeway Award to wonderful actors who have to deal with crappy writing because of how they're... I don't know much about the history behind this, but on an episode of, I believe it was Cortex, he talked about how there were dueling factions on the Voyager writing team. People who wanted to make Janeway loving motherly and people who wanted to make her strong and rather... strong-willed and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so there's weird fluctuations between things of her. I was looking for that in this episode, but there really wasn't much of that. But I can imagine, you know, in other episodes when she may fluctuate wildly. But no, she's a fantastic actress from what I've seen this episode.
Yes, and I mean, there's not a lot of Janeway in this episode, but every scene she's in is a good scene. Although I did think... the Janeway I know would have struggled a little more with the choking, but I guess she wasn't Janeway at that point.
Exactly.
So she was acting, and I guess she was choking herself in Tom's body. I don't know.
That's so bizarre.
I can't keep it straight. But then Tom wakes up in Steth's body on the ship, and he finds himself immediately in trouble because apparently Steth goes around causing trouble for everybody. So, they accuse him of stealing the ship that he's on, and then the other alien that has had her body stolen by Steth is like, give me back my body, and he's like, I am not Steth, I don't know what you're talking about,
yeah.
And it's, you know, a comedy of errors.
That's what confused me, was because she showed up even though at one point Steth's body turned into hers. I was like, wait, is this a flashback? Is this something the first time they met? Who knows? But at this point... they all realize that something is screwy here.
That's right. They go back to Voyager, and at that point on Voyager, they're realizing something screwy because Janeway is like, oh, I need to go to sickbay because I know what's happening. But she's not going to sickbay. She's going to steal a shuttle because she wants to get the heck out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chakotay is like, WTF. And Tom Paris in Steth's body is like, no, I'm totally not Steth. And Janeway's totally not Janeway. And you have to believe me. And Chakotay's like, why would I believe you? And he says, oh, we had that talk not, you know, 24 hours ago about how I'm underperforming. And Chakotay's like, okay, I totally trust you.
There we go. That's all you need at this point.
That's right. And there's also kind of a creepy part where Steth as Tom Paris seduces B'Elanna, and who's Tom Paris's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And one assumes they sleep together, which is kind of creepy.
That weirded me out. There's a moment in a completely unrelated show called Steven Universe where something very similar happens, and it reminded me a lot of that. And it was, the ramifications on that show were much bigger than in this one, because I guess at the very end of the episode, she doesn't consider the fact that she slept with someone who wasn't actually her boyfriend.
Yes, it is weird, because so Tom Paris, as we said, is having some ennui, and so that extends to his personal relationship with B'Elanna, and so he's been spending his time in the holodeck and not spending time with her, and she's unhappy about this. But then it's a whole new Tom Paris who wants to spend a lot of time with B'Elanna
and go to the beach,
and go to
which
the
would
beach.
Be a problem.
Yes, and you know, go AWOL for 24 hours on the beach, because what can Janeway do?
Exactly.
And B'Elanna's like, dude, we're Starfleet officers. We can't do that.
He's like, nor can they drink either, but then Seven of Fine comes in and catches him being drunk on duty, which is also not okay.
That is not okay. And also reading Janeway's personal logs. How he gets those, I don't know, but
I'm guessing he got those in the scan of Tom's information earlier
right.
on.
Because he has a little pad that can override Voyager's security very easily just by
a little one password
it.
Thing.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, whoop, okay, you've got access.
Now, there's something I want to ask you about all of the computer stuff and a lot of the words I use. First of all, do you ever get used to the jargon? It seems very made up and very, like, it explains things that are happening in the moment. But have you ever seen something like coaxial space warp drive or advanced subspace supergeometry? Like, do you recognize terms like that as you watch more Star Trek?
Well, you certainly will recognize the roots of it, right? So subspace is a thing that they talk about a lot. The warp drive, they talk about all the time. And so this is one of a Star Trek writer's favorite answers to plot difficulties. Just have an actor babble out some techno babble and maybe get some kind of strange proton or particle involved. And it will solve all of our plot problems.
Exactly. And then also, all the computer readouts are basically gibberish. They mean nothing, but with the right dialogue, they can mean anything, which is, again, another way that they can get out of either add tension or get out of some sticky writing situation, which I think is brilliant.
Exactly. And I did think it was fun so the computer is, there's a voice interface. And so on Starfleet ships, it is a woman's voice. In fact, it's Majel Barrett's voice, who was married to Gene Roddenberry. A little fun fact. Although she's dead now, so I don't know what they'll do for any future Star Treks. Sad. We're bringing the podcast down. She died a few years ago. She is missed. She did a great job. She played Nurse Chapel and Lwaxana Troi on The Next Generation. And also the ship's computer voice. So it's a female voice. It's friendly. Much like, you know, Siri's voice, although you can change Siri's voice to a man if you want. Or Alexa.
Can she show you all the James Bond movies with Sean Connery in them?
I bet you she could.
I bet she could. If he can get back in white cartoons for Tom Paris, I'm sure she can get all the James Bond movies.
I think so. You probably could get your James Bond movie on the holodeck and live through it if you wanted to. Which would be kind of cool.
That'd be really cool.
But on the other guy's ship, because he's villainous, the ship's voice is a male voice, which in Star Trek is always jarring because it's always a female voice. And that lets you know, whoa, I'm on a different ship.
Right. I guess I didn't realize that because Steth, who was actually Tom, didn't seem that fazed by the fact that it was a male voice at first, or otherwise I didn't notice if he was, but that's not something that I didn't get the significance of that.
I don't know if there's any big significance, but it's just from someone who's a Star Trek obsessive. It is a little bit. So, well, they figure out who everybody is, the Doctor, in a scene we don't see, figures out how to swap everybody back. Everybody does it. The Doctor feels quite self-satisfied.
Technobabble, technobabble.
Exactly. And then the person who is actually owns Steth's body decides that he is going to spend the rest of his life trying to figure out how to get everybody back that Steth, the previous Steth, had taken. So he's going to go off and track them down, I guess. And we end this with B'Elanna Torres and Tom Paris having a little talk about, you know, I should spend more time with you. And then she goes to the holodeck with him and sees the car. And she's like, you spend time here. This is kind of gross. And then they go into the car and they start making out.
And it's very, very sweet. And it's all, you know, the grass is always greener on the other starship or whatever. And it's not necessarily that case, because, you know, I like the dual storylines of the Ennui and the Body Snatcher, which I thought they worked out really well, because there's a line somewhere towards the end when they're having their showdown on the bridge, and he says, you know, I lived in your body for 3 days, and I can see why you wanted out. I was like, no, I want to be back with my girlfriend, and that's when they realize, that's when something in him flips, and we get a nice little character moment at the end when they make out in his not-real car.
That's right. And to be honest, I mean, it's nice. It's a refreshing viewpoint on Star Trek, because one of the hallmarks of Star Trek is that everybody in Starfleet is competent and loyal and excited to be there and explorers, and they're all doing their job and they're, you know, they're contributing to the greater good, right? Mm-hmm. Because we've all, mankind, or humanity, I should say, is elevated itself. And we're all looking towards the future and working together to make the world better, or the universe better. But it's nice to get a character who's like, you know, I kind of have to do all this stuff, and it's not really great, and I can't get back home, we're stranded, and this kind of sucks, and I don't want to help the Doctor. I just want to play with my imaginary car.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's upsetting, but at least he finds something back on the ship that he can do that is at least more fulfilling, or at least he gets to a refreshed view of his life on the ship, which I think, yes, is great.
And I think we get the sense that this has been kind of a boring period in Voyager's journey home, because the Doctor in the beginning says, hey, you have to come sickbay and finish your training, and he's like, we haven't dealt with anything more than a hangnail in months. So not much is going on. So I think Tom is just bored and he wants something to happen.
Yeah. So why not invest hundreds of hours into a fake car?
Exactly. But then something happens. His body is snatched. He finds a new ship. It's all very exciting.
Scott McNulty, this was an absolute blast. Thank you so much for revitalizing my interest in Star Trek, because after I watched the Abrams movies, I went back and watched the original series, the Tribbles episode, and stopped. Well, so thank you for getting me back into it. This has been a huge amount of fun.
You are welcome, and I hope that you explore more that Star Trek has to offer, because while I think this episode was fine, it is not the shining pinnacle example of Star Trek that you might want to seek out. But it's not bad. It's for a Voyager episode, especially for a Tom Paris-centric Voyager episode. This is fantastic. Next on Random Trek, Voyager Season 1, Episode 10, Prime Factors.